It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, personal health information from millions of patients in 21 states was collected by Google as part of a secret project. We'll learn more in just a bit. First, according to Airlines for America, 31.6 million Americans are planning to fly during the Thanksgiving holiday period. Sunday, December 1st, is projected to be the busiest day ever with 3.1 million. So in addition to dealing with security, overweight bags, and overbooked flights, get ready for some poor airline etiquette, like the passenger in the seat next to you taking off his shoes.
Oh, that feels good. Oh, God, I'm telling you. My dogs are barking today.
Whew. Do you tell the guy to put his shoes back on? Do you complain to the flight attendant? Do you shame him on social media? Or does he have every right to take those shoes off? Jody R.R. Smith is the president of Manor Smith Consulting in Marblehead, Massachusetts. She's the author of three books, including The Etiquette Book, A Complete Guide to Modern Manners. Jody, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. And I would have a hard time shaming John Candy.
Me too.
He's way too endearing, and I'd like to think that his dogs might have been barking, but hopefully they didn't smell too bad.
Definitely. Now, before we get into some specific airline issues, Jody, it seems like you're cooped up in an airplane or maybe even a bus or a train with other passengers. This is going to be maybe a tough time for our personal etiquette, right?
Yes, it's one of those things where I certainly want people to be uncomfortable in the best possible way. So we know that we have to get from one location to another. We have to do it with people that we don't know, really strangers. And while we don't want people to feel like they're at home in their living room, they should be able to think about what other people are thinking and feeling and smelling and seeing. And if that means I have to be uncomfortable and keep my shoes on, then I have to keep my shoes on.
Is there something that leaps out at you as the most common etiquette violation that we might see on an airplane?
I think the biggest thing that I see and I hear about over and over again is that there's so little space. Unless you're fortunate enough to be flying in business or first class, you're really squeezed in like sardines. And I get asked over and over again, if you're the middle person, which armrest do you get? And the answer is both. The person that's next to the window gets to lean on the wall of the plane on the window. The people who are on the aisle get to lean towards the aisle. And the person who's stuck in that middle seat gets to claim both of the armrests.
Is that a generally recognized etiquette rule? Because, I mean, I've been in that position and had no clue if there was a guide to who gets those armrests.
Yeah, so you always have to take everything with a grain of salt. So I don't like to talk about etiquette in terms of rules. I like to talk about them in terms of guidelines.
Ah, okay.
So if you have a 2-year-old whose arms don't even reach the armrest, and you have a 6'3" basketball player who can literally touch both sides of the plane at the same time, then you're going to accommodate based on body size and your position and how kind you happen to be feeling that day.
Let's talk about that attitude of kindness, because it seems like people, they might come onto that plane with their dander up, especially maybe on a busy holiday. They almost missed the plane. They took a long time getting through security. How can we make sure we're in a considerate attitude when we look at these etiquette decisions?
Yes. So I encourage people that once you get through security, once your bags are away, once you're sitting down, take that deep cleansing yoga breath. Acknowledge the person that you're sitting next to. This does not mean that this person needs to become your Uber best friend for the next 6 hours, but at least say hi, ask if they're going home or going to, have a little bit of a chit chat so that you can get a feel. Is this a nice person? Is this a considerate person? And if they seem upset, maybe something you can say can help to ease them. And I can give you a very specific example from the last time I was just on a plane less than a week ago. And I sat down and the woman who was in the middle seat seemed excruciatingly agitated. And so I started talking to her. And what came across is that she had an extreme fear of flying.
Oh.
And as somebody who flies all the time, both for business and also to be able to travel, I know a lot of the noises on an airplane. I know what the sounds mean. I know what the beeps mean when they're ringing for the attendants. And so I was able to talk her through a lot of the things. And you could actually see her starting to calm down even before we took off, that I was able to help her calm down. It didn't mean that I wanted to talk to her through the entire 3.5 hour flight, but a good solid 20 minutes at the beginning made everybody's flight a little bit more comfortable.
Talking to Jody R.R. Smith from Mannersmith Etiquette, author of The Etiquette Book, A Complete Guide to Modern Manners, talking about travel etiquette on airplanes in particular. We can lump buses and trains and subways, whatever you might travel on with other humans at the same time. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234, maybe with your own experiences, your questions for our guest about what to do and what not to do on a plane. Jody, we've seen this going on for some years now, especially with, as you mentioned, the cramped space on an airplane, the recliner wars. Do we or do we not recline our seats? Where do you fall on this one?
Again, it depends on your actual size. So if you have a 3-year-old toddler sitting in a seat, they really don't need that seat to recline. If you have somebody who is of bigger stature, they need those extra 2 inches. And if you're somebody who tends to be a little bit smaller, then allow the other person the extra 2 inches. For me personally, I find that the reclining of the airline seats is actually not good for my back. It's much better for me for the back to be straight up with a little lumbar pillow, which I don't carry lumbar pillows with me. I usually just roll up a scarf and put that against my lower back. And that's how I'm going to be able to survive that particular flight.
Now, what about the situation where the person who wants to recline thinks they have a pretty good case and the person behind them thinks they have a pretty good case? What is the right way to communicate with one another?
You certainly can politely ask someone not to recline, but since the seats are designed to recline, that person does have the option. And then you have the option as to whether you want to create that domino effect and you recline and the next person reclines and the next person reclines, or whether that 1.5 inches that you've lost is something that you can live with during that flight.
We heard on Facebook.
What you're not allowed to do is you're not allowed to do some sort of strange yoga position and get your feet on the back of the seat and shove it forcefully forward. That's not allowed.
We heard on the Ideas Network Facebook page from Luke, who says, I just flew yesterday. The seats recline maybe 3 to 4 inches at the top. Where people's knees are, there's little to no encroachment on the seat behind. They just don't recline that much. So Luke says, just do it. What do you think?
Actually, I agree with Luke. I like his spirit. I like the attitude. And talking about foot room, you have to have your bag underneath the seat in front of you during takeoff and landing for safety reasons. The second we're at our cruising altitude and you hear that first bing to allow the flight attendants to know that they can get up and move around, I take my backpack and I put it underneath my knees closer to my seat so that I can actually put my legs underneath the seat in front of me, which is much more comfortable. So if you're looking for leg room, use the space underneath your knees to put your bag and actually stretch your legs out underneath the seat in front of you while you're at the cruising altitude. It gives you a lot more room.
Now, earlier we heard John Candy taking off his shoes in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. British Airways conducted a survey a couple years ago. 59% of passengers said it's okay to take off your shoes, but they say leave the socks on. 87% said bare feet, a definite no-no. What's your take on footwear on the plane?
Okay, so I have a lot to say about this. So for me, the issue is not the actual bare foot or the sock. The issue is the smell. So if you know that you have an issue with your feet starting to smell, your feet need to be encased in your sock and enclosed in your shoes. If you are somebody whose feet do not smell and you want to take your shoes off, or you were wearing flip-flops or sandals because you were somewhere beachy, that's fine. But what you're not allowed to do is go barefoot up and down the aisles and into the bathroom.
Ew.
Because that's gross. And you're also not allowed to shove your toesies on the footrest in front of you so that as I'm sitting there, I can see your little piggies wiggling. You have to keep your feet in your own space.
Rules we can all live by. We're talking about proper etiquette for airline passengers. Jody R.R. Smith is with us, president of Mannersmith Consulting, the author of 3 books on etiquette. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What's the most annoying thing you've experienced on a plane? Are you wondering what to do when someone else commits a certain breach of etiquette? Do you need some clarity on the rules regarding armrests, overhead bins, reclining seats, footwear, or some other issue. We can include planes, trains, and buses in the story as well. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Look, I don't want to be rude, but I'm not much of a conversationalist, and I'd really like to finish this article. A friend of mine wrote it, so...
Don't let me stand in your way. Please don't let me stand in your way. The last thing I want to be remembered as is an annoying blabbermouth. You know, nothing grinds my gears worse than some chowderhead who doesn't know when to keep his big trap shut. If you catch me running off with the mouth, just give me a poke in the chops.
It's Neil Page and Del Griffith, Steve Martin and John Candy on their way to Chicago, they hope, in planes, trains, and automobiles. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time, and we're talking about airline etiquette, like the overly chatty passenger with Jody R.R. Smith. She's president of Manor Smith Etiquette Consulting in Boston. She's written three books, including The Etiquette Book, A Complete Guide to Modern Manners. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If you ever sat next to a passenger who didn't stop talking or took off their shoes or put on too much perfume, what you do about it, if anything? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jody, let's talk about conversations on the plane. I usually don't want them, but one time I had a great conversation with a total stranger on the train. So what do we do?
What I like to do is to have that introductory chit chat, and that I think helps to ease a little bit of the tension, and you are going to be sharing space and more likely than not at least touching elbows or shoulders at some point along the way. So you don't necessarily need to introduce with your name and where you live and your social security number, but at least a hello and a little bit of a chit-chat, but then you are not obligated to provide this person entertainment during the entire time. And luckily nowadays, it was much harder in the olden days when you only had a book as a refuge, but nowadays people have the iPads and they have the televisions built into the seat in front of them and they have the earbuds. So there's lots of ways to use your electronics as a social safety net if the person happens to be talking a little bit too much for your liking.
Well, let's bring on a caller. I think on this topic, Emily is with us in Plymouth. Emily, hi.
Hi. Yes, I was just... So I have no problem with chit-chat, and I enjoy that and everything, but I'm a single mom, so I look forward to flights because I get to read a book, and it's very enjoyable, and I will usually, you know, go to the library, pick out some books just specifically for that trip. And to me, when someone pulls out a book or they have their ear, you know, phones in or whatever, that to me is like the universal symbol for I'm not really up for a lot of conversation. Is that true, or am I imagining things? Because a lot of times it seems like me pulling out the book is the person's cue to like start talking about their childhood in Birmingham, and I have no desire to engage.
Emily, thanks. Jody, what do you think?
No, she's right on track. You're using the book and the earbuds as a social cue that you're not engaging in a prolonged conversation. And it is perfectly polite and acceptable for you to say, you know, I'm so looking forward to this flight. I picked out this book special for this flight, and I'm just going to read. I hope you enjoy the rest of your flight. And then you open up your book and you start reading. And there's nothing wrong with that. You can be very direct and kind at the same time.
Emily, thanks for that call. I'll point you toward the morning show tomorrow morning at 6. Emily, Kate's guest, says we can get a lot out of talking to strangers. So a counterpoint there, do with it what you will. We'll go back to our callers. Jenny is with us in Lake Geneva. Jenny, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to mention an awesome Instagram page. It's called Passenger Shaming. And they have people every day posting all sorts of things. So it's hilarious and it's educational, and people get to post things they've seen on airplanes, things they've heard, etiquette tips and things like that.
Jenny, thanks for the call. Now, Jody, we see this. I don't know if this one has pictures of, you know, the bad passenger on it. What do you think of the etiquette of social media shaming of those bad passengers?
Oh, I'm so torn, because public pressure for your behavior is really what etiquette is all about. Etiquette comes into play before we have to get law enforcement involved. With the shaming, though, I want people, when they decide to do it, to have given the person every opportunity to make it right. So if somebody has stuck their feet up between my armrests and I've turned around and I said, I'm terribly sorry, would you mind, can you please put your feet down? And then they don't, then they're eligible. If, however, there's a child who's behind me who's screaming and it turns out that this child has special needs, that's not okay. So if you have to be able to ascertain whether this is somebody who is capable and able to behave in a socially appropriate way and is choosing not to, versus somebody who just being on the airplane was a huge step forward for them. So that's the guideline of caution that I put around that.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Marina joins us now in Pleasant Prairie. Marina, hello.
Yes, hello. I have a question. I have a situation where it's my ankles. It's a medical one, and a lot of people have, some people have this, where your ankles swell like almost three times the size, and this will happen even on a one-and-a-half hour flight. So, and then plus, I would love to be able to fly to Europe, but I'm too afraid. I don't know how I can flex my, you know, put myself in a proper position to prevent that from happening. Does she have any ideas?
Wow, so that's maybe somebody who would really want to put their legs up on the seat in front of them, I guess, Jody.
Yes, so here's the deal. If that's what you want to do or want to be able to do, the seat in front of you is not always easy to do unless you're on a train and you have the seats that are facing each other. But if you know that you're going to need to put your legs up because of a medical reason, you may need to buy the two seats next to you. And that way you can sit sideways and put your legs up. I am not a medical professional. I'm not a doctor. I do not play one on TV. So you should definitely talk to your healthcare providers. But there are also little things like compression hosiery that people who travel for business wear on a regular basis to prevent blood clots. So if you know that you have a medical situation, speak to your doctor, speak to the airline representative and see what you can do. It is not acceptable, though, for me to have paid full price for my seat and to have your ankles on my lap. So we have to be able to take those things into consideration.
Marina, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Good luck coming up with a solution there. We're talking about airline etiquette. Jody R.R. Smith is with us with Mannersmith Etiquette Consulting. She's the author of The Etiquette Book, A Complete Guide to Modern Manners. Let's talk food that we should and or shouldn't bring on a plane, Jody.
Oh, my goodness. You've hit upon my pet peeve, my personal pet peeve, which is stinky food. Anything that is way too fragrant, or nowadays they love to have these mall kiosks in the terminals with all that fun, fast, and quick service food that doesn't always agree easily with people's stomachs. So if you're going to be eating something that has a lot of beans in it, maybe you shouldn't have that right before you get onto an airplane with an enclosed space where you can't open the windows. So really think, know your own gastrointestinal tract, know what you react well and don't react well to, and bring things on the planes that are not going to make the entire plane smell like a senior dorm.
Well, and I think about, you know, some foods I don't usually think about as smelly, but in enclosed space, like a hard-boiled egg. At home, I wouldn't even think about it. In a tight space, smelling somebody else's egg, that kind of sulfurous smell can kind of build up. It kind of narrows the window a little bit of what we can tolerate.
It really does. And I encourage people, if you're going to eat, you have time in the terminals. You have to get there so early to be able to get through security nowadays. Use that time to be able to eat whatever it is that you want to eat so that when you get on the plane, it's not an issue. I do encourage people to bring, I know it's counterintuitive, but I do encourage people to bring food on the plane. But I want you to choose foods that are not going to smell up the entire cabin.
Let's go back to our callers. Chris is on the line in Waukesha. Chris, hi.
Hi. I'm calling because one of my pet peeves is that when I travel with a bag that I check and pay extra to check, and then I have my briefcase or a backpack as a carry-on, and I check my suitcase so that then I will be able to have my foot space. And so I'm wondering, am I in the right to expect that I should have overhead compartment space for my briefcase, or should I have to give up that foot space in order for the big roller bags that people have not checked?
Ooh, interesting. Jody, what do you think?
Oh, I'm literally biting my tongue as you're talking because this is something that I completely agree. Unfortunately, the space in the overhead is not allocated per seat. There simply is not enough space to be able to say that if you're in seat 17D, you get this space in the overhead compartment. The airlines are banking on the fact that some people will be checking their luggage and other people will be bringing less. And according to the airline, so this is not an etiquette guideline. This is not something that I have helped to create. This is according to the airlines, the roller bags go up first. Then if there's extra space, the backpacks, the briefcases, the soft-sided luggage, and the coats go up in sort of that order. And while I totally get where you're coming from, and if I was queen of the world, everybody would have an assigned space to be able to use directly above. That's not the way airlines work. And so unfortunately, what that means is that if it's a full flight, there's a chance your briefcase is going to be in the space underneath the seat in front of you. I'm sorry.
Chris, thanks for the call. Jody, in our last few moments, you know, we're all fighting with each other as passengers, but it's the airlines who set the amount of space we have and the rules. Could they do a little something to make life easier and to help people get along better?
They certainly could. I loved when JetBlue had the first bag checked free. It made such a difference. Everybody was checking their bags and made it so much easier to get on and off the planes. There was plenty of overhead space. And then, of course, they realized that there was a marketing opportunity to make a profit. And now they charge for checking the bag. So if I was queen, especially going into the holiday season when you know that all of the airplanes are going to be totally booked, if you book early, you should get a free to check the luggage for free. And that way, and send people to book early, they fill up their planes, and you also have less of the luggage coming on into the passenger cabin with you.
Jody, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Jody R.R. Smith, author of The Etiquette Book, A Complete Guide to Modern Manners. We talked to her about some of the most common violations of air passenger etiquette, what we should do instead, and how we should handle someone else's bad behavior. Some planes, trains, and automobiles music taking us into the news. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A bill that would have changed state restrictions on how close sex offenders can live to schools and other places passed with unanimous support, but Governor Evers recently vetoed it. We'll find out why and how lawmakers are reacting coming up. First, an initiative spearheaded by Google has privacy advocates worried over the state of our personal health data. According to an investigation by the Wall Street Journal, Google partnered with the national nonprofit clinic and hospital chain Ascension to collect and compile data from patients without their knowledge or express consent as part of the technology company's Project Nightingale. Ascension has several clinics and hospitals in Wisconsin, and the news about the project has drawn concern from federal lawmakers. Our next guest has been covering the developments in this story. Sarah Needleman is a technology reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure.
Well, how did you and your colleagues first find out about this Project Nightingale at Google?
Well, I have to give credit to my colleague, Rob Copeland. He is the main Google reporter, and his reporting uncovered that this project was underway. It started last year in secret with St. Louis-based Ascension, and it's called Project Nightingale. That's the code name. And basically what it means is that Google has been working with this large healthcare system to collect and crunch the detailed personal health information of millions of people across 21 states.
This appears to be under federal medical privacy legislation legal, as far as we can tell. Is that right?
Well, under HIPAA, which is that was enacted many years ago, even before Google was around, that made it okay for healthcare companies to share private information of patients with third parties under certain circumstances and not have to disclose it. And so Google has said that in this case, it follows those guidelines.
What is Google saying they're going to do with all of this patient information?
Sure. What Google is looking to do is bring it to the cloud and make it easier for medical professionals to be able to access patient data. And so you can imagine that this is a massive undertaking because we're talking about a lot of data and putting it into the cloud. And so this way you would potentially be able to access very detailed information about a patient almost to the point of real time. And that's not something that is widely available today.
So that's for an individual patient. I know Google and companies like them like to do a lot with big data. Is there some notion that, okay, we're going to have all this information and be able to do these massive data crunches and learn more about what makes one person get, say, diabetes down the road, something like that?
That is some of the potential discussion around how this data could be used. It's hard to say at this point what the technology will be able to determine, but the idea is to be able to come up with recommendations on how someone should address certain health issues or identify problems that might be worth having a person go check out. And so you might get an alert saying that your information suggests that you may have some sort of medical condition that you should check out.
Now, you mentioned that this isn't disclosed to patients or their doctors when this information goes. So when I go to the doctor, I think, okay, they might share this with the hospital if they give me a referral. They'll probably share it with the insurance company, whatever. I don't probably go in thinking, yeah, Google is going to see my test results. But they can.
I would agree. That is something you probably wouldn't think, but this is modern times. And when HIPAA was put into law, this wasn't something we had even fathomed. It's not something we thought about. It was beyond our understanding. This is a very different world we live in today. And so there are a lot of big tech companies that are trying to get into the health business. Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, they're all aggressively pushing into healthcare, though they haven't struck deals of this scope to date. But there is a lot of interest among the big tech giants to get into this space. It could be very lucrative, and they do believe that they have the kind of technology that could ultimately benefit people.
Now, Google and all the companies just mentioned know a lot about any particular individual. Is there a thought that they might take the Rob file from healthcare and merge it with the Rob file on online shopping and my Fitbit or whatever? Could they be merging all these different sources of data with the medical data?
That is a common fear or concern that people have raised. Google has said that it will not be used for advertising. We need to go by that. We do know that Google doesn't necessarily have the best track record in this area. For example, its YouTube unit agreed in September to pay $170 million in fines and change its practices in response to complaints that it illegally collected data on children to sell ads. So what Google may say and what it actually does may not jive. But as of now, Google has responded to the reporting that the journal did on this topic and has said that it is not planning to sell the data for advertising purposes. What else it could use it for? It's a good question. It's hard to say.
Sarah Needleman is with us, technology reporter for The Wall Street Journal, looking at Google's Project Nightingale, partnering up with a big healthcare provider to collect patient data. Sarah, you've written about some of the government response to this. Let's start with the Senate. A bunch of people from both parties in the Senate not wild about this idea, it sounds like.
Right. There are officials in the government that are looking closely into this, and they've launched a federal inquiry to find out more information since, this really came out of nowhere. So the Office for Civil Rights and the Department of Health and Human Services said they're going to seek to learn more information about this mass collection of individuals' medical records to ensure that HIPAA protections were fully implemented. And HIPAA, again, is that federal legislation I mentioned from back in 1996.
And in the U.S. Senate, some people are calling for more investigation or maybe oversight?
There are some senators who have spoken out. For example, Mark Warner of Virginia, Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, Lisa Murkowski, Alaska, and Richard Blumenthal, Connecticut. And I hope I got my name's pronunciation accurate there. But they have all spoken out and said, you know, this is something that should be looked at. Mr. Warner called for the project to be halted pending an investigation. He said a moratorium should be applied to any similar deals involving a company already under a consent decree agreement for serious privacy and security violations, which is the case with Google, as I mentioned a moment ago, with regard to YouTube. And Ms. Klobuchar, who is a presidential candidate, she said that Google's trove of health data warrants more government oversight because, she said, quote, there are very few rules of the road in place regulating how it is collected and used.
Now, this story is about Google and the healthcare provider Ascension. As you mentioned, there are a lot of other big technology companies who want to get into the health game. There are a lot of other healthcare providers. It's hypothetically possible that there are other similar partnerships going on that wouldn't have to be disclosed to patients.
That is potentially the case because of the HIPAA legislation. And so one of the concerns or requests brought up by these senators that I mentioned is to see if whether or not that legislation still holds today, because, like I said, it came out in 1996. That was well before Google was around. But generally that law allows hospitals to share data with business partners without telling patients. But again, that's as long as the information is used to help the covered entity carry out its healthcare functions. So there are rules around it. But generally speaking, yes, they have the freedom to share that information. And so Google has said that they have followed the law and that they're cooperating with federal investigators.
When it comes to this Project Nightingale from Google and Ascension, what's out there still that we don't know that you'd like to find out?
Well, so yeah, we don't know what we don't know. I think there is some question as to who has access to the data. We believe that a large number of at least 150 Google employees have had access to it. Who are these people? What training do they have in handling this kind of sensitive information? You know, who are they and how long have they been working at Google? I think those are some just very basic questions. Same on the other end of Ascension. You know, who's handling this data and working with Google on it, and what are their potential uses do they see for this data? So maybe they've said they're not planning to use it for advertising purposes, but they could they be using it for something else that we're not thinking of? You know, where do we draw the line in terms of what data is acceptable to be shared with a tech company? And what are the potential problems that we might need to deal with if there's, for example, just you know, simply if it's hacked, if the cloud system that Google is creating for Ascension, what if you know bad actors somehow get a hold of it? There are all sorts of questions about security and the steps that they're taking. And when you're dealing with medical data, you know, certainly one bad judgment call, one glitch could have a very serious effect on a patient. So all these thoughts are coming to my head, and I'm sure there are a lot of thoughts that everyday readers have as well, because there's nothing more important than our health in terms of, you know, living day to day, and making sure that we're protected is very, very important.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Sarah Needleman is a tech reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She joined us today to talk about Google's secret health data initiative called Project Nightingale, which collected the private health data from millions of patients around the country. Coming up, we'll hear about a bill Governor Evers recently vetoed that would have given counties more say over where convicted sex offenders can live. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Governor Tony Evers has pressed the state legislature to act on issues with broad public polling support like gun reform and Medicaid expansion. Republicans have said no, saying polls shouldn't take the place of elected lawmakers. We'll talk about the role that public opinion does and doesn't play in state government. Now, some state lawmakers are unhappy with Governor Evers after he recently vetoed a bipartisan bill concerning where sex offenders can live. Right now, they can't live within 1,500 feet of places where children are like to be. Think of schools, parks, or churches. Under the new proposal, that distance requirement would go away, leaving county officials more say over where those offenders can be placed. It would also help keep offenders in their home counties, a provision that was appealing to Republican State Senator Dan Fine of Fond du Lac.
If there's a sex offender from Fond du Lac or Winnebago County, we will take our own. But we don't want to be dealing with the problems of Washington, Milwaukee, Dane, or Racine County up in this area.
Lawmakers also say the distance restriction has resulted in some sex offenders becoming homeless. Evers said the change would have put kids' safety at risk. It's one of many bills the governor has acted on in recent days. Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio's state capitol reporter. Laurel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What exactly would this bill have changed?
So this bill would have lifted some state restrictions on how close people convicted of sex crimes can live to places like schools, public parks, youth centers, and places of worship. And it's something that's kind of been floating around the Capitol for several years now.
And it would have lowered the restrictions a little bit. Is that right? Technically, if this had been signed into law, it would have reduced the restrictions a little bit?
Right. So it would have taken those away, actually. So right now, individuals that are convicted of violent sexual offenses have to live at least 1,500 feet from those locations that I listed. So under this proposal, that feet limit, that specific distance, would be taken out of state law. It would just be dictated that counties that make the decisions about where these folks live would have to take into account where some of those things are located in terms of where the individual might take up residence.
How big a surprise was it that Governor Evers vetoed this bill?
Well, that's kind of an interesting question, Rob. You know, I talked to the sponsor of this bill, or one of the sponsors, Senator Dan Fine, and he said he was really surprised that the governor vetoed this, because it did pass both chambers of the legislature on unanimous voice votes. That's when they just call for a yay or nay. They don't do the individual button pushing, so we don't get a specific number. That's usually done for bills that have a broad base of support. And, you know, it had bipartisan sponsorship as well. So Fine said, you know, this is something that he thought the governor would be on board with. Now, I think there's another element that we could kind of take into consideration there, which is former Governor Scott Walker actually vetoed a very, very similar bill to this. So there was kind of that twist where, you know, we've seen a governor push back on this kind of thing before.
Now, when people in the public hear this, they might say, wait a minute, you want to allow convicted violent sex offenders to live closer to schools? That sounds bad, I guess, on the face of things. What were the arguments from the sponsors of this bill? And again, the unanimous vote in the legislature, what were the arguments in favor of making this change?
So the argument was that it's really difficult for some counties to find a place for these folks to live that meet that requirement. Particularly some supporters of the bill brought up urban areas where it would be very difficult to find a place that isn't 1,500 feet from any of those one things that I listed before, you know, public park, youth center, place of worship, school. So they said that having that restriction on certain counties has actually required some officials to actually place these violent sex offenders outside of their home county. And that was something that really concerned, particularly Senator Fine, who was one of the sponsors of this. He's from Fond du Lac. And he said that individuals that are convicted of these crimes that are from counties like Dane or Milwaukee are being moved. The word that he used was dumped, actually, being dumped in counties like Fond du Lac County or Winnebago County, which he represents. And he says that, you know, folks that live there are okay with housing their own, but they don't want to take on the problems of folks from other counties.
Talking to Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio state capitol reporter, about a bill in the legislature that would have changed the rules over where convicted sex offenders can live, how close they can be to schools, public parks, child care facilities, and other places. Governor Evers vetoed that legislation. What was Governor Evers' argument about why he vetoed this bill?
So the governor said, and this was a similar argument to what former Governor Walker said when he vetoed a similar bill in 2018, he just said he thinks that this change would compromise the safety of children in Wisconsin. He really likes that 1,500-foot limit from some of these specific locations and thinks that the state needs to continue enforcing that kind of distance to make sure that children aren't threatened by some of these individuals.
Now, given the high level of support, as you said, a unanimous voice vote, is there talk yet about lawmakers trying to override the governor's veto?
I haven't heard anything about that. I did ask Senator Fine, you know, what are next steps for you now that you've got this sort of unexpected veto? How do you move forward? He said, admittedly, it's kind of late in the legislative session at this point. Lawmakers are expected to wrap up around March or so to reintroduce the bill with some changes that might appease the governor. So it seemed to be, at least from his kind of first blush take on the path forward, that nothing is likely to happen for the rest of this legislative session. They would have to come back in the next biennium.
And looking again at the details here, as you mentioned, we have this 1,500-foot guideline. What do we know what the reasoning is behind that very specific number?
You know, that is an interesting question, and that's another thing that the senator brought up. He said that he believes it's a very arbitrary number, and that's why he was okay with taking that number away. I think another interesting thing to mention is just that in addition to that requirement that the state law puts on officials trying to locate where these individuals can live, there are also some penalties for not identifying a place for them to live quickly enough. And some counties have said that that's really burdensome and is costing them money. And so that was a kind of another part of this debate about repealing the current law as it stands.
Before we let you go, for the holidays, Laurel, there were a lot of bills signed, a few vetoed over the past week and a half or so. Anything else stand out to you as particularly significant in this passel of legislation?
The governor has been very, very busy signing bills over the past few days. He signed more in the past few days than he had in the entirety of his tenure up to this point. So I think, some of the big ones, he signed a bill changing the regulation of hemp in Wisconsin. That's an industry that a lot of ag watchers have kind of pegged as something that could be the future of the industry in the state. So that's pretty interesting. He also has taken action on a fun bill that would allow kids to have lemonade stands as long as they don't make a certain amount of money over the course of a year. So, and I expect we're going to see some more pretty soon.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio's state capitol reporter. We touched on a couple pieces of legislation there that the governor did sign into law, and we talked through about Governor Evers' veto of a bill that would have lifted Wisconsin's state requirements on how close sex offenders can live to things like schools, parks, youth centers, and other spaces. It would also have prevented sex offenders from living outside their home counties. Evers said the change would have compromised children's safety, as we heard. Lawmakers may revisit this idea in the weeks to come. Interested in hearing what you think about this idea. In your community, have you heard reports of sex offenders living in places that had you concerned about their proximity to people, especially kids in the area? Do you worry about state regulations making it hard to cite these convicted sex offenders after their release in their own community, or in some cases having to transfer them to other counties around the state? We've heard concerns from some state lawmakers about that. That was part of the motivation for this new law. Are you a local official or in local law enforcement? What is your perspective on these things? And if you're at the county level especially, this would have given you the discretion. You can let us know what you think. Tweet us at Central Time WPR, or as always, you can email ideas@WPR.org. This weekend marks the 65th anniversary of an attack on Earth from outer space. Sort of. As reported in Smithsonian Magazine, on November 30th, 1954, people in Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi reported seeing a bright reddish light crossing the night sky. It came down in Sylacauga, Alabama. Witnesses near the scene thought it was an airplane crash. First responders arrived at a local house expecting to see the wreckage of an aircraft. What they found instead was an 8.5-pound meteorite, a wrecked radio console, and a woman who woke up suddenly with a massive bruise on her side. The woman's name was Ann Hodges. The meteorite apparently bounced off her radio and hit her while she was sleeping. And to this day, 2019, she is the only person ever to have been officially confirmed as being injured by a falling meteorite. She survived the experience mostly unharmed, except newspapers at the time ran pictures of the bruise on her side. It looks like she was hit by an 8-pound meteorite. What ended up happening to the meteorite itself? Ann Hodges ended up keeping it after a brief legal battle and a cash settlement with her landlord. The family used it as a doorstop for a while. Eventually, they donated it to the Alabama Museum of Natural History. Are you worried about the same thing happening to you? Probably don't worry so much. The odds are against it, but keep a big radio near your bed just to be on the safe side. Meteorite prevention news you can use. This is Central Time.